The following program is an MLWRadio.com production.
Matt! Boo!
Media Productions. You remembered them fondly, and then they were gone. And now you want to know who, what, where, when, why. Why It Ended with Robbie E. and Matt Coon.
Hello, guys. This is Robbie E., and I wanted to welcome you to myself and Matt Coon's podcast, Why It Ended. How you doing, Matthew?
Hey, guys. we're doing it.
Hey, man. I mean, I can't talk like I normally talk because you make fun of me.
Now, let me ask you a question, Robbie. Are you Robbie E., or are you the Rob Strauss brand?
Right now, I'm still a little of both, because Robbie E.'s on the Why It Ended podcast, but Robert Strauss brand is slowly, you know, in the works to debut for House of Hardcore in a few weeks. So I'm kind of both right now. But with you, Matt, right now, I'm Robbie E.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, let us smarten you up just a little bit and check out Robbie's social media to see what the Robert Strauss brand? Is that what it's called?
Yep, the Robert Strauss brand debuting for House of Hardcore in a few weeks. You can see it on my social media, Tommy Dreamers, House of Hardcore social media. It's a new character, and I think it's going to be pretty crazy.
And it's truer to the Robbie E. that I know. And also, something that wasn't a debut was Why It Ended last week, because we had Al Snow on. It was our most downloaded, most popular, most heard show ever. We're really starting to blow up. People love the Al Snow interview, and people really got a lot of information and really reacted strongly to the Just Incredible follow-up.
Yeah, and have you heard anything? Have you talked to him all week? Because I know you talk to him regularly.
Yeah, I've talked to him almost every day. And, you know, one thing is that we talked about maybe keeping more stuff off of Twitter. And I think he's following that advice. And I think Justin's doing better now. He's got a lot of people in his life that care about him. But make sure you are one of them by Twittering him at PJ Polacco, Just Incredible, and let him know what he means to you. And to stay strong and keep up the good fight, which is what we're doing here. And Robbie, you can tweet Just Incredible, but you can also tweet us, right?
Yeah, you can tweet us with wearing one of our shirts that you could get on Pro Wrestling Tees. I know right now, as I am talking over this microphone, I am wearing the Buff Bagwell computer shirt. What are you wearing? Please don't say you're naked.
I am not. I am wearing the brand new logo shirt. Make sure we got a brand new logo shirt and a brand new logo, so make sure to check it out at prowrestlingtees.com/whyitended. And check out our YouTube as well. All you gotta do is go to whereitended.com. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, we're at whyitended, or Robbie on Twitter at Robbie E Impact, or me at Matt Coon Music. Of course, we also have an Instagram too, right, Robbie? That's where all the good looking people go.
Yeah, at Why It Ended on Instagram, and I am at Real Robbie E on Instagram, and he is at Matt Coon Music on Instagram. You know, we throw a lot of things out for you guys. I hope you, when you listen to our show, you have a piece of paper and a pen and pencil ready to write stuff down, because we throw a lot of information your way. We move quick.
Now, someone who's going to throw a lot of information is Simon Gotch. You know, it's really cool because we haven't had anybody who was just in WWE, who had just changed their character, who had it just end for them. And we have an interview with him coming up, and we're going to ask him all the tough questions, Enzo, and about the vaudevillains and all that stuff, and what he's doing now. What are you looking forward to talking about with our good friend Simon Gotch?
I'm just looking forward to talking to him in general. You know, I met him maybe about a month or two, and he's a super cool dude. He's very intelligent, and he's funny, and he's entertaining to listen to. So I think this is going to be a great chat, and you guys are going to like it. And there is going to be a lot of surprising things about his journey to the WWE and then now the aftermath that you didn't know about him. So it's going to be super cool.
You know, I like that he talks like this. I like that very much.
Yeah, he's got like a, you know, he's got like a cool little vibe to him.
And he tells all, and it's a great interview, and it's coming up on Why It Ended right after this. Hey guys, if you are a regular listener to Why It Ended, then you know we are definitely in the top 1% of all wrestling podcasts, and you can advertise to tens of thousands of our listeners. So if you have a wrestling-related product, or service, or you just want tens of thousands of males between the age of 25 and 44 to enjoy your product or service that you want them to hear about, contact us today by email at whyitendedmail@gmail.com. That's whyitendedmail@gmail.com. Now, if you contact us today, you can advertise on next week's show, which will definitely be our biggest and most popular show of all time with Marty Jannetty. So make sure to contact us today via email, whyitendedmail@gmail.com, and you'll be saying woo, woo, woo to all your new customers. You know it. All right, so joining us now, you may know him as Simon Gotch, but right now he goes by Simon Grimm with MLW and a lot of other wrestling around the world. We're joined by Seth, but we're going to call him Simon. How are you doing today, Simon?
I am wonderful. Thank you for asking.
Hey, Simon, thanks for doing this, bro. And I just wanted to say, I think you're going to be a great guest for our show because a lot of the guys that we've had on, their biggest TV runs have ended like a lot of years ago. You're very current. So I think your story is going to be very different for our fans. We appreciate it, man.
Try to bring something different to the table, so I'm glad that I can do that for you. I mean, you are a pleasant individual. We actually, you and I met for the first time about a month ago, I think it was, for Zello Pro when you wrestled Colt Cabana.
Yes, this was in Chicago.
Milwaukee. We were in Milwaukee.
You normally run in Chicago. You're right.
I don't even know what the Milwaukee basketball team is, but apparently we were running a show across the street from the Bucks? Across the street from the Bucks game. Oh, we still are all right, but they're trying to charge us $50 to park in the building we were working at.
Wrestling.
Because apparently it's Bucks VIP parking during the games.
Well, whatever. They got to make their money. But so anyway, the first question that we always ask every guest, we get right into it. Very generic, basic question, but we want to know to get the ball rolling a little bit. How did you originally fall in love with pro wrestling?
I started watching it as when I was a small child. I probably 3 years old is my earliest recollection. Me and my older brother used to watch the WWF Saturday Sunday shows on USA Network.
How old are you?
I'm 35.
Okay, and I'm 34. So this was what for you, 1985?
85, 86, somewhere in there. I couldn't tell you exactly because I don't really remember not watching wrestling at any point. That's just sort of my earliest recollection. I knew being 3 years old, I knew who Hulk Hogan was. I knew what professional wrestling was.
So who were some of your favorites like when you were growing up?
Bulldogs, Hart Foundation. I remember always listing Ricky Steamboat as a personal favorite, though I could not name a single match he had. And because this was the thing where I grew up, we didn't get any NWA or WCW until Nitro. So I never saw him during his WCW run. I only saw him around the time of WrestleMania 3. And I know I saw the match with him and Savage because I watched that whole pay-per-view. But if you'd asked me to name a single match he had, I wouldn't even remember that. I only remembered that match when I was like 19, 20 years old. When I
because it's a cool match that everyone talks about as like the greatest match ever.
People say that, yeah.
Yeah. Me from my childhood, I don't remember it much either, but it's just everyone talks about it. But I don't have like these great memories when I was younger from it.
Yeah, I think most of my memories were really made more when I was a teenager, when I was after that point, because obviously then your memory's better. You're going to be a little bit more attached to that stuff.
How did you come about to start training as a wrestler? You have a really interesting list of trainers, you know, from Donovan Morgan, Michael Modest, who a lot of people know from the famous documentary, and also Daniel Bryan and Harley Race. How did the training start? How did you get interested? And who do you give credit to for starting the Simon Gotch, Simon Grimm pathway to wrestling?
Well, that blame can fall squarely on the shoulders of Rob Van Dam.
Oh, boy.
So right out of high school, I was 17. Me and my brother, we're obviously both big wrestling fans. At the time, ECW had been doing their run on TNN. Yeah, we were big into watching it. We'd get the pay-per-views, and we saw they were coming to California. It was going to be the first time in California. So we find out about the pay-per-view. We get tickets. We decide to drive down there. I'm 17. I just graduated high school. Halfway there, my car died. I blew the soft plug, cracked the engine block. So it was actually dead. It wasn't even like, oh, it's dead. I'm going to have to get a new battery. It was like, no, this car's actually dead. You're never going to see it again. So we hopped a Greyhound the rest of the way, met up with my granddad. He let us borrow his car to go to the show. I broke my foot somehow. I'm still not sure how I did that. No, I was like limping the whole day and I couldn't figure out why my foot hurt so bad. It turned out I'd fractured the top of my foot. So there was that. So I go to the show, you know, we're enjoying it, whatever, having fun. And this was, if you're not familiar with the whole lead up, Rob Van Dam had been turned on by Scotty Anton. And he was promising he was going to debut a new maneuver to defeat Anton called the Van Terminator. No one knew what it was. I saw Van Dam hit it. I didn't even make a sound. I just looked around and saw everyone else losing their mind. And I just thought to myself, I want to be a pro wrestler. This is what I want to do with the rest of my life.
Seth, not to get nerdy on you here, but that first one that he did he hold the chair while he did it, or did he prop the chair up?
I think Fonzie held the chair.
Matt, you are so nerdy.
I don't believe he did that. I will say that at, you know, 17, I was super impressed by it. But at, again, 35, knowing that the ECW ring, I think, was a 16 by 16, you do the math on that. You're like, okay, well, let's see. He's 6 foot tall guy. So right off the bat, he's maybe going two body lengths in ring to actually hit this kick. I mean, it's cool. Don't get me wrong. But at the time, my mind was completely blown by it. But it's that sort of thing where you go back and look at it and it's just like, oh, that's cool.
Was this your first ever live show that you went to?
It was actually my first live show. We did not grow up well-to-do, so while we always would talk about going to wrestling shows, we never did it because the closest that came was San Francisco or Oakland, which was still an hour drive, 45-minute drive, easy. You take that, and then on top, you know, cost of gas and getting out there, then on top of that, cost of tickets, which, I mean, at the time, you're thinking of 25, 30, 40 bucks, even though I think they were actually closer to 5 or 10. But you don't know that when you're a kid. You just see, you know, the whole WWF live coming to your town soon. That's where I heard of pretty much every small town that I've wrestled in now. You know, your Hershey, PA's, your Secaucus, New Jersey's, just these random little cities that pop up. And you only know them because WWF went there in the 80s.
Yeah.
There's an insane number of I laughed one time recently because WWE was doing a house show in Terre Haute, Indiana. And I messaged Jason Ayers, who's a ref there, because when Bill DeMott was still the head of developmental, he used to tell guys, hey man, could be worse, right? You could be working in Terre Haute tonight. Like, if you got fired and going back to the Indies, that's the sort of town you'd work in. And I was like, hey man, I thought you had to get fired to work there. He had a laugh with it. He appreciated the reference. But anyway, so that was sort of what got me interested in deciding I wanted to be a wrestler. Because prior to that, I'd thought about it, but it hadn't been that sort of thing that I knew I could do. But I'd also seen Beyond the Mat either shortly before or shortly after that. I'm not entirely sure which it was. And I knew there was a wrestling school in Hayward, which I didn't know exactly where it was, but I knew it was in the Bay Area. So I figured it was within an hour. It wound up being 86 miles door to door each way. So I signed up there. And at the time, Mike and Donovan were the head trainers. And they'd actually just started touring for Pro Wrestling NOAH in Japan. But about 3 months in, so I started in August of 2001. By October, they had a falling out with the guy who ran the company. And they left, and that January, Brian was brought in as a trainer. It's Brian Danielson. And I trained with Brian from January to August 1st was his last day because he went down to start with the Inoki Dojo in Los Angeles. Then I hung around there for maybe another 6 to 8 months, I think it was, before I kind of got tired of the way the place was being run. And I decided to go to Mike and Donovan's school. I trained with them for probably another year and a half after that, before their school finally closed. Then I hung around California for a few more years. Then in 2008, I moved out to Missouri and spent some time at Heart of the Races camp. And I was there until I got signed in 2013.
What kind of like life change was that, moving from Cali to Missouri? Like, how was that something you thought about for a while, or just overnight, were you just like, let's just do it? And I mean, what would you say were the big differences?
At the time, I was trying to get into Pro Wrestling NOAH. And I thought about it because they'd sort of said that would be a good place to be if I wanted to be over there. They never brought me over, which was still a point of somewhat soreness for me, but that's neither here nor there. I eventually sort of decided I would just move out there, and I did, and it was fucking miserable. I'm sorry if you have to bleep that, but Missouri is a horrible, horrible state. I think they should probably nuke the whole state and then cover it in about 5 feet of cement.
And what, is it in a town in the middle of nowhere?
Oh, yeah, it is. It's the school's moved now. It's closer to St. Louis, but it was in Eldon, which is legitimately the middle of the state. Like, if you threw a dart at the dead center of the state of Missouri, it was right there. And it was a 2.5 hour drive to St. Louis and a 2.5 hour drive to Kansas City.
Wow.
Well, first of all, you can definitely curse on the show. We're the lowest. Let's go back just a little bit, though. What was it like working with a young Brian Danielson? Of course, Daniel Bryan. What did he bring to you as a trainer, especially him being so young at the time?
Well, the thing is, he was very young, but people forget that he'd trained with Sean and Rudy Boy Gonzalez down at TWA. He'd already been through the developmental at the time system going to Memphis. So he'd worked with guys like Malenko and Regal and all those cats. So he'd learned quite a bit. And he'd already toured Japan before for FMW. So he'd gotten to train with Masato Tanaka over there as well. It's kind of selling Brian short to say that because he was so young, it's like, yeah, he'd already done a lot. Like, it's more than most indie wrestlers do it, you know, 3 or 4 years in. And on top of that, he'd had been fortunate to train with some of the best in the world. It's really hard not to learn something from a guy like that. And I definitely learned quite a bit. He really had a pretty strong hand in developing my early style and the sort of wrestling that I became interested in. Because again, you go from maybe what you enjoy as a fan to not necessarily what you enjoy when you begin to learn more about wrestling and you start to see what sort of clicks for you personally. You know, there's some guys that get into wrestling, they want to be flyers, and then they realize they don't like that they can't flip. So what do? They start brawling, you know? You can never predict where you're going to wind up. It's just sometimes you'll find something that sort of appeals to you and you go with it. And I think Brian actually had a big hand in helping me find that.
When you look back at Daniel Bryan, we've had people on the show who knew The Rock when they were young, knew John Cena when they were young. And although they can't say this guy was going to be the guy, Daniel Bryan's one of the all-time greats. Did you see things in him that we've heard from other people, such as maybe a work ethic or a drive? Could you tell he was just driven to be the best?
There's some people that it's their thing. I don't know better way to describe it. I wouldn't even describe it as a drive, because drive to me is like, that's like an obsession, like an uncomfortable, you're driven to do something. You're driven mad, so to speak. You know, that to me doesn't sound like a positive. He was passionate about wrestling. He loved it. He loved talking about it. He loved watching it. He loved dissecting it. He looked at wrestling the way that like a Gordon Ramsay looked at cooking. It wasn't so much that he was driven. It was that he was passionate about it. And he really enjoyed doing it. It wasn't just about, you know, making money. It wasn't just about fame. It wasn't about girls. It was about, I love this. This is what I like doing. Dean Malenko had actually said something one time when I was in developmental, where he said, some guys think having fun in the ring means going out there, you know, grabbing each other by the dick and, you know, pull my finger and then I'm going to kick you in the nuts when you do it, stuff like that. And he's like, to me, having fun is going out there and having a crazy ass match with my buddies and having fun with it, like really going out there and giving our all. And that's probably the best way to describe it, is that Brian's the type of guy where he's going to give 150%, not because he has to, not because he's trying to get over, but because he really likes to give 150% because it's fun for him.
Well, that certainly makes sense. You know, I just think he's awesome. And it goes to everything I've heard about him, that he loves the art form. Real quick, though, can you give us a good Harley Race story?
I've got a few of them. One, a buddy of mine went over to Japan. He went to Ribera Steakhouse and he found a photo of Harley and Bruiser Brody on the wall. So he snaps a picture of it with his phone, gets back, goes up to him. He's like, hey, boss, take a look what I found when I was over at Ribera. Oh, it's me and Brody. Don't know why I would have been out with that guy. I never liked that fucking asshole. Like, oh, okay. The other one being Harley has this weird, his memory is not all there anymore, but he would have these little flashes where he would remember the strangest stuff and he'd just tell you. And he called me into the office one day, and I can't even remember the exact roads, but he calls me in and he goes, when you're going up past Kansas City, take the 408, because if you take the 310, you're going to be stuck all day. Right around this time, there's going to be bad traffic.
Awesome. Well, when you first got there, was he more, what you said in 08, was he more with it?
When I first met him in 06, he was. By 08, it was sort of the tail end, because it started to be, I think it was the next year was when his wife died, because she took really good care of him, and I think she kept him on a routine that helped a lot. And I think now that he doesn't really have that, that's sort of when he started to go a little bit. A guy had asked how to take my finisher. I used that Tiger Driver, and I was showing him how to take it. And Harley walked by, and he just went, when you're doing that butterfly suplex, make sure you let go at the top and belly out. That way the guy lands flat.
That's good advice right there.
Oh, it's great advice, but it wasn't what we were doing. So the guy, I've got locked up. He goes, what did Harley just say? And I went, he thinks we're doing a double underhook suplex. Don't worry about it. Because I knew he was at that point where if I tried to correct him and be like, no, boss, we're doing this, it wouldn't have gone any way I wanted it to go.
Yeah.
It would have become butterfly suplex 101, because that was kind of the point he was at.
Hey, so did you ever end up going to Japan ever in your career yet?
Only for WWE.
Is Noah something you still want to do? Is it still on your bucket list?
Anywhere in Japan, honestly. I'd love to, any of the offices over there, I'd love to work for, just because I like the fan base. I like the style. I like the guys.
So in 2008, the reason you moved to Missouri is you want to hopefully get hooked up with some Noah stuff. But 5 years go by, it's 2013, and you eventually get signed to NXT. How did that happen? Who signed you? Who called you? Were you happy? Was that your dream? Was that what you wanted then? How did that all come about?
Basically, what had happened was I was turning 30. So we're going back to the Camp Harley ran in 2011. Regal was there, and he saw me, and he was putting over my work. He's like, oh, you know, you solid work. There are no holes. You got all the little in-between stuff, and I'm waiting for that. You know, that
but,
like,
the butt.
But.
Oh, no, not even the butt. I'm waiting for the, and your tryout is going to be on this day.
Oh.
Obviously, they're like, and? Oh, nothing? No? Nothing? Oh, okay. Nothing. Fuck me, right? So it's like, yeah, it's just all, here are all these compliments. Good day. So about a month later, because the camp wound up being in December of 2011, that was actually the worst year of my life, not the least of which my house burned down that year. My house burned down. A friend of mine committed suicide. My girlfriend at the time, her mother and nephew both died of cancer.
Oh my God.
Like this is just a ridiculously bad year. So coming out of it, I was like, you know, that camp thing, I was like, there's a cherry on top of the sundae. You know, it's, I get all this praise and I can't even get booked. So I wind up doing an extra talent spot in 2012 about, I think it was the last day of January and the first day of February. So I guess January 31st and February 1st. At the time, a buddy of mine, Brian Breaker, he wrestles in Oklahoma. He was in developmental for a little while as Brandon Traven. He did a dark match with, actually, I think it was on maybe Superstars or Main Event, one of those, with Brodus Clay. They really liked it, and they basically said they were going to sign him. I talked to him a bit about it. I said, hey, man, congratulations. He said, hey, if you want to talk to Regal, here's your chance. I run Regal down. I start talking. I literally had to run him down because Regal, at that point at least, moved surprisingly fast for a guy who was not running. I don't know if he knew I was following him, but he definitely made me work for it. So I finally chased him down. I was like, look, man, you know, I'm turning 30. I've been doing this for a while. What do I got, you know, at the end of my rope? And he looked at me and he's like, oh, you should try getting into Ring of Honor, get some TV experience. I said, I talked to Ring of Honor. They won't use me.
What was the reason that Ring of Honor wasn't interested?
They didn't give me one. They just didn't respond to my emails. I assume if you don't have emails, you're not interested. Yeah. I mean, it's a crazy assumption. I know. You know, if I call you, you pick up the phone. After a while, I start to figure you're not picking up because you see the name. You're not because you're busy.
Hey, maybe the emails got lost. You never know. You know how that works.
Oh, yeah. You know.
Do you have any idea how many people have lost emails that Robbie E has sent them, Simon?
It happens to me every day.
But I did hear that your former tag partner, Danny Echos, had told me that you were on more than one occasion had pulled the, when a fan asked you for an autograph, I'm just going to put my bags in the car. I'll be right back.
Definitely on more than one occasion. Yeah.
Holy shit. Really?
Hey, well, listen, I mean, you know, sometimes it's busy nights.
You got a place to go, you know?
Well, you finally make that contact and...
Oh, no, I didn't make the contact. Regal was like throwing every possible, hey, do this instead of talking to me. And I kept shooting him down, explaining why they wouldn't work. And then he looked at me for about 5 more seconds and said, you look like one of those old timey strongmen. Make a video and send it in. So I made the video.
Were you like, what the fuck are you talking about? Or were you like, I get it? Because you weren't doing that character, right?
I sort of was. Back in 2010, actually, I'd grown the mustache out. October 2010 was when I first, actually, it was my birthday and I received a mustache wax, for a gift for myself. And the first photo of me I had was October 18th, 2010. So
everybody buys himself mustache wax.
Hey, sometimes you got to. No one else is going to do it. I did that, and I started mixing up my style a bit because I was a big fan of Minoru Suzuki. So I started trying to mix stuff in that I liked of his, and I started referring to myself as the well-mustachioed gotch stylist because his whole deal is gotch style power driver. Fast forward, Regal was like, okay, do something like that. So I basically had to tweak the gimmick a bit. I changed up the gear. I went from trunks to the one-strap singlet, and I made this short video. I sent it in. It went to a guy named Matt Martellaro, who basically his job was the filter for everything that got sent to the company. If you sent them any promo videos, unrelated. Oh, my God. I just forgot. I'm just going to throw this in here because I totally forgot about it right now. Harley used to have a stack of promo videos the guys had sent him over the years just in the office because he didn't have anything to do with them. And one of them was for a young Rob Echos. Where,
oh my God. What color tights?
Holy shit.
I don't know the tights. I just remember the promo where you were wearing, I think, a white Trilby hat, a headset, and you were singing the song Beautiful Girls by Sean Kingston. You walked in. That's all I remember.
That was the Platinum Papa, Rob Echos.
Beautiful Girls, which is about killing yourself because of a beautiful girl, I guess. I don't know. If you're not Chuck D, I don't care. That's just how I feel.
Hey, why Chuck D? Why only Chuck D? I mean, not that that's a bad thing. I'm down with Public Enemy, but why him?
The voice of the people.
All right. I'm with it.
You can't be a Public Enemy fan and be a Flavor Flav guy. That's not really a thing.
I've met Flavor Flav. I was not impressed.
So let me ask you this. When you think about that video that you sent, it's your one shot. When you think back at the video, is it a video you're proud of that you grabbed the brass ring and sent it in? Or is it something that if you saw now, you would just slap your forehead and say, oh my God.
Actually, it was just really easy. Rather, it was easy to put together. The actual process of editing it, it took me about 45 minutes to shoot everything. And then it took me about 2 days to edit it. And I probably swore death upon every human in the world in that 2 days because it was the most arduous and painful editing process I've ever gone through.
Well, you, my friend, have never edited an Al Snow interview, so just saying.
Hey, hey, I get told I sound like Al Snow a lot, so I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not. I'm starting to think it's an insult. But when I heard back from Mark Laro after WrestleMania, he basically said it was 6.5 minutes, which is way too long for a promo video. That being said, I watched all 6.5 minutes because it did interest me. He tells me they're going to bring me in for Raw 1000 and the SmackDown after that because they happen to be in Kansas City and St. Louis those days.
Meaning as an extra.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I wind up, I showed up and the first day, because when we go to change into our, you know how you get your gym shorts and your sneakers on,
yep.
You know, get bumped around or roll around in the ring a bit. Rather than putting on gym shorts and whatnot, I put on my wrestling boots and I threw on this red and white striped bathing suit, like the old short shirt combo. And I just walked around in that all day. That created a bit of buzz and got people excited, I guess. They were talking about it because they're like, you ever seen this fucking guy? What's his deal? Then the next day, I was supposed to actually have a match with Ricardo Rodriguez for the agents. And I wound up having one with Xavier Woods. Woods loved the gimmick. We went out there. We had a match. And while we were out there, I started noticing like all the agents. Like, because normally I figured it was just going to be like one or two agents. But it was like everyone was out there. And then I wound up seeing Triple H come down. Triple H really liked it. Then I went to the promo room, did some stuff by myself, did some stuff with Damian Sandow, which wound up going nowhere, unfortunately, but I felt like it could have gone somewhere. And then Rod Zapata, the ref, came up to me and said, I think they're going to sign you. And I was like, I don't know, man. He's all, no, Triple H doesn't watch matches. He watched yours. They're going to sign you.
So do you leave that night saying, holy shit, like it's happening. This is, you know, like, did you think it was going to happen within a day?
I was hoping for at least a little bit more, shall we say, confirmation. The reality of it was WWE was never a place I was passionate to go to. I threw myself headlong into it because I was like I said, I was going to be 30 that year and I had never made a full-time living as a professional wrestler. And it was kind of shit or get off the pot at that point. So I was like, if Japan isn't interested in me, then I guess I'll pursue this avenue because at least it's a paycheck, right? So I think it was after SummerSlam, I got called back and told they were going to bring me in for a tryout in October. I did the tryout. Tryout went well. I got told in December I was actually going to get signed at the opening of the PC, which at that point I think was supposed to be in February. It wound up being in July.
Well, that is a very long process.
Yes.
At that time, though, a lot of people think of it, myself included, longtime NXT fan. And that's kind of the golden age of NXT. Who else was there down? Who was there with you, especially getting signed right when that PC opened?
When the PC opened, it was me, Danilo, Dan Echoes, Bull Dempsey, Bull James, Sammy Callahan. I don't think he started that week. He showed up the first day, but he had some contractual stuff he had to get through. Slate Randall, Eli Drake, whatever you want to call him. I know Alexa Bliss had already been there for about a month when they opened the PC. Wesley Blake, Buddy Murphy, Becky Lynch, who else? Marcus Louis. There were a lot of people, actually. I think Wesley Blake is the longest tenured person who started the day the PC opened, who's still in NXT.
With all these talented people and the people that are already there, did you feel like you belonged? Did you feel like, okay, I know it's not your passion, but you're trying to make a living. This is your break because you're smart enough to know you can make a living if you go this route. Was it something when you start getting in the ring with all these people and all these trainers, is it like, okay, I belong here. This is what I can do?
Not exactly. I was basically being told from day one I sucked and had no idea what I was doing, but they did that to everyone, so I didn't really feel special.
You're funny the way you talk. What was like a typical – so what was like your typical week there? Was training was what, Monday through Friday and then shows on the weekend, or how does it work?
It varied, particularly the first few months because there's so much media stuff going on. It was a lot of random like, hey, you have to be here at 6 a.m. and you're going to be here until 7 p.m. The normal training day was you'd go in to have ring time, which was 3 hours. You'd have a lunch break, which is maybe an hour to 2 hours, depending.
And then ring time, you mean what, someone's leading a class kind of thing?
Yeah. You'd be in one of six rings, which you might be with Terry Taylor, Billy Gunn, at that point, Joey Mercury, Robbie Brookside, Norma Smiley. The girls were all in one class with Sarah Del Rey, Sarah Amato.
Was there a trainer you would prefer to be in the ring with? Like, would you say, I'm with Norman today? Or is there someone that you really connected with as a trainer?
I always got along really well with Norman and Robbie. Terry Taylor, I like as a person only because, if nothing else, he's fun to torment. towards the end of the time in NXT, English and I were just kind of the terrors of his class. And in the most subtle way possible, where he'd say something about a match. He'd be like, what about this, Terry? You said this before. Yeah. Shouldn't we do that? Yeah. Shouldn't we supposed to get that? Aren't we supposed to grab the hold like that? You said we're supposed to grab the hold like that, Terry. And we just kept doing that to him until one day he actually pulled us aside and asked us politely to stop doing it.
He actually tormented me in TNA. He actually tormented me. It was the other way around. So you're lucky that you got to be the one doing the torment.
Well, at that point, everyone reaches the breaking point in NXT where they don't care about getting fired because you've been there long enough. Oh, no, it happens to everyone because you've been in the developmental system so long that you know they might fire you at any time, but you have also given up hope they'll call you up, but they're not doing either. You're like, they're not calling me up and they're not firing me.
So fuck it.
I don't care. Yeah, I'm just going to have fun.
Is it purgatory?
That's probably the best way to describe it. A little less pleasant than purgatory is sometimes, but you know, that's varied.
Was there any trainers or guys there that you didn't get along with that were hard to work with that ended up leaving or just, or they're still there or anything?
Not really trainer wise. Obviously, I was no fan of Enzo. I've never made that a secret.
And what was that reason? Just attitude or?
He's a fucking idiot. You know, if you were to look up the word idiot in the dictionary, you know what you'd find?
I could take a guess.
Definition for the word idiot, which he fucking is. Okay, I will apologize because I stole that from a movie called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, but I love that line.
What is that for someone, you know, like me? I'm a fan. Robbie's a wrestler. I've heard that a lot. I've heard that the WWE took the opportunity to get rid of him because he was a headache for a lot of people. What is it about Enzo that rubbed everybody, including yourself, the wrong way?
For me, it was very early on. I caught on to his formula and his personality, and I didn't like either. So his formula promo-wise, because initially I actually enjoyed the first promo I heard from him. Then I heard a second one and realized what his formula was. He would basically hit a catchphrase, cram a bunch of one-liners in as fast as he could for about a minute, and then he'd hit another catchphrase. And when you realize that's what he does in every single promo, and you can go back and look, and for every one random, very specific promo he does on a person, which is actually much more rare than you may realize, most of them really do break down to just that formula. He'll open with his line about being, you know, certified G and a bona fide stud and all that stuff, and then he'll close with soft. And in between, it'll just be a bunch of
filler.
Yeah, a bunch of disjointed, unrelated one-liners. One of them I remember using on Us very specifically was, "You boys keep reading them books, we'll keep writing them."
And when you don't like a guy and he says something as banal as that, you just want to fucking kill him, don't you?
Here's the thing. You can take your one, you can do five one-liners in a 1 minute promo, or you can do one really good strong one-liner that actually hits and lands. Mike Modest has a story that Ricky Marvin told him. If you don't know Ricky Marvin, he's a phenomenal luchador. He did a lot of work.
Oh, I know Ricky Marvin.
Okay, then you know Ricky Marvin, then you know what's up. Mike got along really well with Mil Máscaras because Mil apparently is super racist and hates Mexican Americans, but he loves gringos. He loves white guys. Don't ask me why. That was just a story that Mike told. He asked Ricky about Mil one time, and Ricky's like, "I don't like him." He asked why. He said, "Well, he used to make fun of me." Apparently, one time, Mil walked up to him in the locker room, and he's all, "Hey, Keith, let me tell you something. My flight on the way over here, the plane, she lose a wing. So I hop up on top of the plane. I surf her down to earth. Plane crashes. Everyone dies but Mil Máscaras. Then I'm cold and I'm hungry. So I find a bear on the mountain. I lucha libre the bear. I rip his skin off. I eat his meat. I put the fur on me. And I walk down the hill." And Ricky's just looking at him like, okay. And Mil goes, "What, you don't believe me? I thought little kids supposed to like fairy tales." So it was this huge, because he would always give Ricky shit about being young, because I guess Ricky broke in at like 14, 15 years old. So Mil would just ride him mercilessly about his age, about how young he was. But he did this whole long, drawn-out story just to get to the joke of calling him a little kid.
Right.
I prefer that to Ricky Marvin. "You're so young, blah, 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 you know, yeah, you're a young guy." Blah, blah, blah. This is just cramming out the one-liners one after another. Even a guy like Rodney Dangerfield, whose whole bit was one-liners, he at least had setups to the one-liners.
Right.
If Enzo had said, "You boys seem pretty well-read. You seem like the type of guys that read a lot of books. Well, you know, you keep reading those books. We'll keep writing them because we're leaders, not followers." Be like, okay, cool.
Wow.
You've set me up. You've knocked me down. Instead, if you just say, "You keep reading the books, we'll keep writing them," it has no context. It makes no sense.
So why do you think everyone was into him so much? Why did everyone love his promos?
Well, again, at the time, it was very different than what a lot of guys were doing in NXT. Some of the promos would come across because, like I said, if a good one-liner hits, a good one-liner hits. And they get a laugh. But I got bored with them very quickly for just that reason, because I had started to catch on to the formula. And at a certain point, it's like, if I've seen one, you can show me the greatest match in the world. Once I've seen it, I've seen it.
Yeah.
So if I see something that's not that good, but it gets a laugh, and then I watch it a second time, like the movie White Chicks. You watch White Chicks the first time, Terry Crews at least will make you laugh. But you're not going to laugh a second time. You're not going to watch the movie a second time and go, "Oh, man, this movie's hilarious."
I actually don't even think I liked that movie the first time.
Yeah, I'm with you, actually. hey, but Simon, what, this isn't the Enzo show, but I do have one question. From what I've seen, you know, of all the documentaries taking place, you get a lot of feedback. Like, you probably got a lot of feedback that you accepted or didn't. Enzo must have gotten a lot of feedback about those promos. Did he just kind of shake off the feedback that he got and just did whatever the hell he wanted? Or were they cool with his promos?
They were cool with his promos. They were absolutely cool with his promos. And the other thing being just the flip side of this, because the outside the ring stuff, Enzo's personality was very grating. I sort of noticed he would try to buddy up the people when he thought he could get something from them, and that didn't sit well with me. That was the other side of it. Like when Fergal, Finn Balor got there, he immediately was just dick riding him to high heaven. Right away. Oh, bro, you want to get chicks, you know what you got to do? You got to get an apartment downtown, bro, because then you know, you can walk to all the bars, walk right home.
Just knowing that he was so well-liked and he was going to be a big deal, he said, let me latch on to him.
Yeah, and Fergal, let's be real. The guy has 9 million abs.
Yeah, he doesn't need help.
He was an Armani model in Japan. Like, the guy could go to a monastery where they haven't seen a woman in 100 years and pull ass. Like, it's not hard for him to get girls.
Enzo's not helping Fergal pull ass, for sure.
No, not in the least bit. But again, he made Fergal laugh, so Fergal was like, oh, yeah, this guy's not that bad. But even Fergal lost his patience with him eventually. It just took a while.
So they eventually paired you with Aiden English. Like, how did that come about? Were you cool with them previous? Was it your guy's idea?
It was Triple H's idea.
Did you get along with him well beforehand?
Well enough. I mean, it was just that sort of thing where we had kind of similar shticks. So I think he sort of was a little wary of me when I first got there. But I've been told before, like, even people who just seen us, like, who had nothing, who knew nothing about either one of us when they saw us, like, you guys look like a team. So it wasn't that shocking when they wanted to put us together.
So, quick question. What the fuck was that? Like, what is a vaudevillian? Like, what's the story? Like, what's the background of you two guys? Are you guys from a time machine? Or, I mean, I'm not trying to be, I never quite understood what it was.
Well, it's what you call poor production. No, my whole idea was just that I thought we should just be a couple old carnies. That was my only idea. That was how I thought it should have been presented. Was it? I'm literally a carnival wrestler, and English was the singer on the carnival circuit. We're out of a job, so we came to WWE because, you know, I'm the best in sports. He's the best in entertainment. This seems like the best place for us, you know? They had a wildly different idea.
They wanted you guys to actually be from 1900.
I don't think they knew what they wanted. I think they knew what promos they wanted to do. I think they knew what vignettes they liked the idea of, but I don't think they knew what they wanted to do with us. I would get that sort of shit from fans all the time where they'd be like, oh, you're supposed to be from the 1920s. You have a Twitter account. All I could think was, okay, so one of two things is true. If I'm from the 1920s, either I've mastered time travel.
Yes.
Or I'm well over 100 years old. You don't think that I could have just adapted to technology as it comes along if I've lived that long?
Right.
Or if I've mastered time travel, you think I can't figure out a smartphone?
Okay, well, I got to ask you, because you guys obviously know and are smarter than me, but I don't know what a vaudevillian is. So what is one? What does that actually mean?
Vaudeville was a type of theatrical entertainment popular between the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century.
Okay.
A lot of early comedians actually came out of vaudeville. The Three Stooges, when they were young, actually worked vaudeville. Charlie Chaplin, a lot of those guys. It was just a place where comedians, actors, singers could cut their teeth and sort of perfect their craft.
And it was the perfect old-timey word you could combine with the word villain to make you guys heels.
Which, oddly enough, was the one thing about the name I really hated.
Why is that?
I don't like a name that uses a word like villain. I don't like whenever people do that in wrestling, just because I feel like it's painting you into a corner.
Yeah.
And then the worst part of that is also most villains don't acknowledge they're villains. They think they're the good guy.
Very true, because, you know, the greatest villain feels justified in what they're doing. And of course, getting painted in a corner is what you guys did, because not only were you, you know, had the name villain, but you appeared to be from the 1920s. But let me ask you this. Something happened. Something worked. You guys were good. You guys caught fire and you guys got attention. What do you attribute your success to in the NXT that led you to being crawled up? Because it was kind of happening for you guys, I got to admit, as a fan.
That is the perception, but if you go back and look at it, what actually happened, we were an example of something that worked despite everything nothing was supposed to work, I think is the best way to put it. I think we were an example of an act that got over 100% organically because people thought it was ridiculous and they couldn't not look at it. But the company didn't really seem to know how to do that or what to do with it at that point. If you take a look when we debuted, people thought it was interesting. They were at least laughing at it, thought it was, they were like, okay, this is crazy. I have to see where this is going to go next. And then they started doing the promos with us where they were supposed to be silent and they left the audio in twice. The first time they did it, We're just kind of softly mumbling our words because we're not supposed to have any audio. So, of course, the promo gets put on air with us talking, and people are like, oh, these guys can't cut a promo at all. Why aren't they talking? It's like, because we weren't supposed to have any audio. They're supposed to play the music and do the title card. So all this stuff like that where they just couldn't seem to get a handle on what they wanted to do with us. They'd use us on TV for a few weeks and then not use us. Then they'd use us on TV again. Then we disappear for 3 months. And then we come back after 3 month hiatus and be on TV as babyfaces, even the last time they saw us, we were heels. Then we'll be heels, but we'll be heels doing entertaining stuff that people cheer. But then we're going to get yelled at because we're getting cheers as babyfaces or as heels. And we're supposed to be getting booed. And then we'll just be taken off TV altogether and not used until we get called up.
So it was just all over the place. Well, what did you guys think of the Full Sail crowd? Like, did they help you? Did they hurt you?
I think they helped. I mean, they liked us. I can't say that their reaction was bad.
A lot of people get kind of annoyed with that, quote, smartness of that Full Sail crowd. Is that something that generally the workers there enjoyed, or was it annoying to them?
And again, it varies. It depends on how they take it. You can be the most annoying fan in the world. If you're buying my shirt, I'm probably going to like you a lot more than if you're not. You can be the most annoying fan of the audience. As long as you're cheering for me, I don't really care.
Sure. I was there in attendance at TakeOver Brooklyn when you guys won the NXT Tag Team Championships. What kind of moment was that for you in front of that huge crowd that was excited and having that big moment and holding that title? What was that like for you?
It was nice to finally feel like they had a handle on what they were going to do with us. I think that was the biggest thing, is because we'd been feuding with the Ascension on house shows. And at the time, the Ascension was looking to drop the tag titles before getting called up. So we thought that was kind of the position we were going to get moved into. We weren't the only ones that thought that. I remember a couple people were surprised that we actually didn't go on and wrestle the Ascension, because we were feuding with them on the house shows. We were having really good matches, and the audience was reacting well to us. So we do that, and then, like I said, we're off TV for a little while, and they brought us back, and then we were off and back and off. So I was like, it seemed like they kept sort of dropping the ball with us. Like, they kept stopping and starting. And so when they did the thing at Brooklyn, I was like, okay, finally, they're like committing to something and they're going with us. And then they didn't.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the gimmicks in NXT. It seems like someone was gimmick crazy for these tag teams. You know, you had the Vaudevillains, you had American Alpha, the Ascension, the Lucha Dragons. Does it seem, looking back on it now, that it was maybe a little cartoonish, or maybe a lot of thought put into these tag teams?
I think at the time they were still struggling with the tag team stuff. A lot of people don't realize the Ascension was the only tag team in NXT for a while. Their gimmick came about because they legitimately had no other tag teams.
Because they were squashing everybody.
Yeah, that was why, because they just did not have tag teams. Because they lost Neville and Oliver Gray to Oliver tearing his ACL. Then I think they had to put the belts on Neville and Corey Graves, which was just a mishmash team. Wyatt family got called up. A lot of the other tag teams either got fired or they just didn't really have, or had been called up, yeah.
And what was it? Wasn't the original Ascension with Bram in it?
Yeah. There was even one before that, or like there's like a version before he even got there that I think had like five members. It was supposed to be True Blood. That was the idea. Was it Dusty? Like, baby, I was watching True Blood. It's like vampires. If they were alive today, that, you know, they wouldn't be wearing capes. You know, that's not how people dress. They'd be dressing like normal people, like you and me. So vampires could be out there right now.
So then, finally, April 2016, you get called up to SmackDown. Were you expecting that to happen? Did you have a lot of prep for it?
No, zero.
Well, you know, like the day before, week before.
Let's see, about 16 hours before.
What, Monday night?
No, we got told, I guess technically 48 hours. We got told at WrestleMania.
Well, that must have been nice.
No, it was not. First of all, I was ready to quit that week anyway. I was just tired of the bullshit.
What's the bullshit?
So after everything with the starts and stops and everything, I was really sort of worn down, because it was like we were a babyface act that they started trying to push his heels. Then they take us off TV for 3 months and bring us back as babyfaces. No one knows. So they're booing us initially. They push us for the tag titles. We do good work with Blake and Murphy. We have great matches with them. God, I think we had a match with Blake and Murphy that was on a house show that actually killed the main event. It was a Neville Owens main event, and they wound up taking the match home early. Neville was trying to get the crowd. Kevin decided he wanted to take it home early. And Terry Taylor put it in the report that we were not to be put in semi-main anymore because we killed the crowd by having too good a match.
Oh, my God.
So we won the tag titles, and it started with them having us lose to the Revival in the first round of the Dusty Classic, a tournament we shouldn't even have been in. We have like a really good, I want to say it was like a good 17, 18 minute match with the Revival on a house show in Texas. And they said they were going to air the match. I was like, okay, well, at least we'll get that. They showed 30 seconds of us getting beat. So not only did we lose Wild Tag Champs, we lost in the most unceremonious fashion possible. Then I saw after the Revival attacked Enzo and Cass, I saw we had them on TV, and I was like, uh-oh, I know where this is going. So we dropped the belts to them, which actually pissed me off pretty bad because we had the UK tour coming up, and I knew if we dropped the tag titles, that was our spot to go over there as the tag champs. And the feud that was starting was going to be with Enzo and Cass versus the Revival. The feud was going to be between them, so that meant that was going to be the tag match going on the tour, not us. And I was really looking forward to that UK tour. So having that taken away right after the tag belts really kind of wore me down because, again, it's like I'm not a mark for titles. It wasn't the reason. It was more the vote of no confidence that sort of seemed to come with that because a lot of people took it as, oh, they must have done something wrong. Oh, man, they must have messed up really bad if the company took the belts off them this quick. And ultimately, the fan base not believing in you can be just as devastating as them not liking you. They can like you, but if they know you're never going to win, it doesn't matter.
Sure.
Like a guy like Dolph Ziggler, they've run him down so much over the years that no one believes he's going to win the big match when he's in it.
Right. And so his promos kind of aren't reacted to because no one really believes there's anything behind them.
Yeah, because they know, yeah, you might get in the match, but you're going to lose. You always lose.
What were you actually doing that WrestleMania weekend? Were you on the NXT show that weekend?
No, we were on Access. We weren't even on the live special.
It really must have blown you like a bit out of from left field when they told you were going to be debuting in 2 days.
I figured we were either getting fired or brought up because we got told we had to talk to Carano.
Right. And for those of you who don't know, Mark Carano is a very high up in the WWE organization. And what did Mark Carano tell you and who else was in the room?
Oh, no one. It wasn't in a room. So Carano was going to have a meeting with us that morning, the morning of WrestleMania.
You guys sent a text.
I got texted and told he didn't have time for it that morning and that he talked to us at Mania. So I'm on like 1 hour of sleep because I was part of Triple H's entrance and they were doing rehearsals until like 2 a.m. And then I had to be up for Access.
Which entrance was this?
The Bone Soldiers coming out with him. I was the first guy in the line to his left is me.
Were you just dying doing that? Were you just like, fuck this? Or were you like, cool, WrestleMania?
I was like, fuck this, mostly because I was like, it's payday, which I think I had to argue to get because they called me up right after that. And I think they're trying to avoid paying me for it.
Hell, you better get that money.
It was only like $250, but it was principal, you know? It was like,
yeah.
That was also where Enzo stole a joke of mine, which Wesley Blake called him out on. So that made me laugh.
What was the joke?
So when we were driving to the building to do rehearsals like earlier in the day, it's me, Wesley Blake, Enzo, and then us, a couple of the people in the car. And I made a joke about, because it was AT&T Stadium, it was something about like having like having AT&T not being able to get any reception in AT&T Stadium, or something about that. And he tells that joke to Triple H when we're standing in Gorilla.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, this motherfucker. And I look at Wesley and he goes, wait, didn't you? I was like, yeah, that's my fucking... And Wesley called him out on it. His response was, bro, you think I even listen when that guy talks?
Now I get why you hate him.
He's a cunt, man.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about Enzo, but you finally get told and you make your debut against the Lucha Dragons. Is there a part of you now that's like, okay, I'm all in on this. Fuck it. The past is the past. We're going to make the best of it. Obviously they see something in us. They're bringing us up.
Yes. And that did not last long.
How much do you credit the accident that happened to Enzo as something that kind of stalled your guys' push?
That I don't know. It's something that a lot of people point to, but at the same time, when we got brought up, they were already starting to push for that record with New Day. We were going to win that match either way. That's one of the big misconceptions about the match we had with them.
You guys lost to New Day at Extreme Rules.
Yeah, because Extreme Rules was the four-way, right?
Yeah, and the accident happened, or Enzo got knocked out when you threw him out of the ring and his head hit the bottom rope.
Let's clarify that. No, Enzo knocked himself out when he went to slide out, when he went to do the spot he's done before where he catches his arm on the rope sliding out of the ring. Let us be clear on that. Steve Austin, regardless of your opinion of him as a wrestler, doesn't know fuck all about physics. If I grabbed you by your belt and your collar and I pushed you as hard as I could, how do you think you're going to fall?
Well,
flat on your stomach.
Right.
Because all the pressure, all the inertia, all the force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is all on the upper half of your body. Your legs would have to try and keep up with that. If you are able to run and slide and get your legs out from under yourself, you are under your own power. Even if you don't believe me, even if you don't believe that I was touching him that lightly, physics make it impossible the way he exited that ring for it to have had anything to do with me. He got hurt because he was way too amped up. if you watch his entrance, you can confirm this, he is running around so fast he actually drops his microphone. The only time I've ever seen him drop a mic.
Do you think he was hyped up organically?
I'm sure he's pounding energy drinks or whatever before the match, but that doesn't change the fact that I was not excited to be in the ring with Enzo and Cass again. It was just getting through it because I knew we had the New Day after that. He was excited to be on pay-per-view for the first time.
And did you catch shit for that?
Not directly.
But you feel it affected you?
It might have. I can't say it didn't, because at the end of the day, even if it's nothing as direct as I'm thinking it's my fault, it's bad publicity.
Were you speaking up that like you didn't want to work with them and stuff? Did a lot of people know it, like agents or other people involved in the match, or did you keep it to yourself?
I kept it to myself.
Yeah.
And at that time, it's a fresh slate. You're reinvigorated. You're trying to make the best of it. And then you got fucking Enzo and Cass again. And then the injury happens. You get drafted. You know, they have the WWE draft and you're drafted to SmackDown. Did you feel still at this point, you felt like the Vaudevillains were going to do something and maybe a future for Simon Gotch as a singles wrestler maybe in the future?
I didn't think I had a future as a singles wrestler, at least not at that point. I felt like the possibility, because we were getting told they're going to re-debut us after the split. And we're going to film these vignettes. They're coming up. We're going to film them. We're getting closer and closer and closer. And it's literally like the day of, and we film nothing.
Of course, after you got drafted, you guys started getting moved down the card a little bit. How did you and Aiden start thinking about where your place was? Did you see the writing on the wall that maybe people didn't like the Vaudevillains as much as you wanted them to?
It wasn't necessarily about seeing the writing on the wall. It was clear they had no interest in using us. Like, I don't even know if I'd say it was writing on the wall. It was just very clear that they had no interest in using us in any capacity. We were there because I think part of the reason we got called up was because they didn't want to fire us. And they didn't really have space for us in NXT anymore.
And so you guys just fell into that chasm of, let's bring them up and see what they can do, see if they can get over, maybe?
Which is the most bullshit thing to ever say.
What do you mean?
Okay, I'm going to take a guy like Ric Flair. I'm going to see if he can get over. Okay, Rick, here's your deal. You're not getting an entrance. You're going to have 90 seconds in ring, and you got to put the other guy over. Go for it.
Yeah, how's that going to happen?
Yeah, you're not going to get over. One of the myths of pro wrestling is getting over organically, because you can only get over organically in an environment where you are given the actual time and opportunity to do that. It's very easy to take that away from someone and still claim, oh, well, you had a chance. You were on TV. Yeah, you gave me 90 seconds and told me I had to go out there and put someone over. My choices are don't listen to you and have a good match. Don't listen to you and go over time. Or listen to you, hope you don't you keep me around because I at least did what I was told, but not get over. So my choices are either piss you off and maybe get fired for that, or do what I'm told and maybe get fired for not getting over.
So what do you think ultimately, as you know, you're at this point now there, what do you think slowly started the process of to you no longer being with WWE?
Pretty much the biggest thing was I was very clear I didn't want to be there.
To who? Who were you making that clear to?
Anyone who looked at me. It was... Anyone who looked at me knew I didn't want to be there. I was very unhappy and I did not hide it.
Okay, so now you're talking to agents, everyone.
I think anyone who saw me, I actually, Steve Linsky, who's a ref over in England.
Yep.
Yeah. Linsky's a good dude. He met me at IPW UK last time I was in England, and he was like, oh, I thought you were a fucking cunt when I first saw you, 'cause you looked just absolutely miserable. I was so worried about you coming here that I realized you're such a nice guy. So yeah, I was really unhappy when you saw me. So which actually, I think the day he saw me was right after we had to do the infamous 90-second match with Breeze Dango.
And by you being unhappy, what do you mean? Sitting, not talking to people, sitting with your head down, like arriving at the ring late to go over the match.
No, it was more like I just looked like I wanted to kill myself or somebody else. I had that look on my face of just utter apathy. I mean, to put it in perspective, I'm a big fan of BoJack Horseman and the Ricky Gervais show Extras. I could not watch either during my time in WWE because it was too real. It was just an existential crisis painted in front of me. And I was like, I can't watch these because they're just bringing up too many actual emotions now.
Did anyone ever pull you aside and say, listen, dude, like it's noticeable that you know, you don't look happy here. You like switch it up or, you know, to try and get you to change?
No. One thing I genuinely did not do. I'm not an ass kisser. I never have been. If I click with you, if I connect with you, cool. If I don't, I don't. I mean, one of the biggest problems you find in WWE is that a lot of the agents are really, I hate to say it this way, they're marks for themselves. If you ever wonder why so many wrestlers on modern WWE television use the moves of older wrestlers, that's the reason.
To kiss their asses.
Kind of, yeah. Because when the guys see that, they're like, oh, hey, hell of a spine buster, just like mine. Hey, you're the one I took it from. Oh, man, that kid, he gets it.
Yeah. On a different level, but same kind of went like that in TNA, same kind of thing for a while. I mean, everyone loves to hear themselves get put over, right?
Exactly. Because if I hit a sweet DDT, people are going to go, oh, hey, Arn Anderson-esque DDT. Arn gets to feel good.
Yep.
These aren't coincidences. And again, I'm not a believer in that. I'm a believer in my work is my work. I work the way I work because I like it. Like, if you find something in it that you enjoy or that you can connect with, cool. But I'm not out there to try and like stroke your ego. That's not my job. But again, that kind of, it's like in politics. I'm the guy that went in there looking to make a change to public service, so to speak. I'm not the guy that went in there looking to get reelected. That shows by the fact that I'm not working there anymore and other guys are.
So who was good at playing that game? And also, who were the agents who were most easily tempted to put someone over if their ass was kissed?
The only one I know of directly was JBL. And I only know that because I guess he hated Curt Hawkins. Because Hawkins had gotten a good jab in on him once with a joke. And he really liked Baron Corbin because Corbin, I saw sit there and talk to him for about 30 minutes about his match with Eddie. And he really liked Corbin and he really did not like Hawkins. So that'd be the only one I could really say that I particularly saw.
Someone like Corbin was good at playing that game or wanted to play that game that you wouldn't play?
Baron Corbin is a politicking motherfucker to the point where I wish I could politic the way he does. He's so good at it. It's freaky. But Tom Hestock is actually a really nice guy. Like, Tom, the guy, is really nice. He is a sweetheart. He's a good dude. If he's your friend, especially, he'll treat you right. But Baron Corbin, the professional, he's like an actual, like, Enzo, to put it in this perspective, is not smooth at all. He's about as smooth as sandpaper. But Corbin is actually smooth. So Corbin can politic, but he's very, like, sly about how he does it. He'll be like, oh, hey, man, you got those new Air Force Ones, right? Yeah, man, I did. Oh, sweet. Dude, I saw a variant on those that are all on leather. They're pretty cool. Oh, really? Yeah, man. They have them over at the Famous Footwear. They're pretty cool. Like, he knows a little bit about everything. So whatever you're into, he can spit on. And it's great. Yeah. And he actually has the capital to back that shit up. I could know everything in the world about cars. I can't afford a Ferrari. So I could talk cars all day with John Cena. But the second he asks me, what do you drive? And I go, oh, a Nissan Rogue. Dadmobile, what's up? But if I'm like, oh, yeah, I got a Miata, you know, that's my weekend car. I tend to get around. I got a Camaro, 67 Camaro, whatever. Yeah, he's got the actual capital to back that stuff up. So it does make it a little bit easier for him to do it. But he's really good at it. Like, I can't even be mad at him.
So how much did your, you know, as you said, your attitude sucked. And for whatever reason, you know, your time was short. You wanted it to be short. How much did your general attitude have to do with the infamous now backstage altercation with Sin Cara?
Actually, nothing. So to clarify again, it wasn't that my attitude was an issue. I always had a good attitude, but I was in a mode where I didn't exactly, I wasn't happy. That's something to clarify. It's like, I wasn't mean or unpleasant to people, but I just had that feeling of like a dark cloud sort of floating over me. What happened with Jorge was literally as simple as, if anything, that was me and him having fun. And he took what I said way too personally and got upset. So really it was more his attitude problem than mine.
Yeah, there, a lot has been made of that fight. Was it a fight? Is that the story?
Dave Meltzer, who I like to refer to as Morty now because he's accurate about 20% of the time. If you know Rick and Morty, you'll know what I'm talking about. What happened was Jorge threw a Coke can at me and caught me right in the eye. I actually have a very nice photo that I had to send to my mom and my brother to let them know I was okay because my brother reads dirt sheets and I didn't want him, you know, finding out about that and not knowing what was going on. But I had a perfect ring where the can had hit me. It was a really good throw. He chucked the Coke can at me. Starts to round the table to try and tackle me. I basically put him in a headlock and held him until such time as we could be pulled apart, repeatedly asking him, dude, what the fuck? Because I had no idea what was going on. I had a probable concussion. I found out later that was kind of Jorge's MO, is that he would cheap shot people, let it get pulled apart, and then just sort of get the reputation as being a badass. I know one of the most infamous one that I knew directly was him and Sheamus. Sheamus is in the medical, the trainer's room, getting his ankle taped. So if you ever sat on a doctor's like exam table to get your ankle taped, you're literally back on your hands, your foot's up, you know, you're not in any sort of position to fight. And Jorge ran up and punched him in the face.
Going back, what was the reason that he threw the cocaine at you? Because of the joke you made that you thought was a joke and he took serious?
That was the reason. We would go back and forth with these little digs. And it was usually like when you get the other guy to go, hey, fuck you, motherfucker. That was like how you knew when you got him.
Right.
I got him with a stiff shot. It was a reference to something that I guess Del Rio used to rib him about all the time that I thought was just a joke. I thought it was just Del Rio giving him shit. I suspect that there might be more to the story, which is why I don't talk about it because it's pretty horrific if it actually happened. But I cracked a joke about that, and I think that sort of hit a raw nerve, whether it was just because of Del Rio always giving him shit about it or because there's more to it than that. I don't know, but it pissed him off.
Was that backstage altercation, him throwing the Coke can and you guys having a little pull apart back there, did that kind of feed into this kind of WWE picture of you as being maybe being tough to deal with backstage?
I think that's what a lot of people point to. But again, as I have to point out, that's the only thing that really happened. I've heard more than once fans talk about, oh, well, he got in a lot of fights backstage. Like, well, no, I didn't. Even if you count that as a fight, that's one. How many others are there? None. Literally none.
Yeah, I've heard that same shit. I've heard the same thing, that you got in fights backstage, but that's the one. That's what you're saying.
Someone actually is like, oh, well, he got in a fight with English. Like, no, I didn't. Someone took an old article about Hoovy from 2006, right when I got released. They reskinned it. It was about Hoovy. And they replaced his name with my name. And they replaced Sekosis' name with English's name. So the story is about Hoovy getting beat up by Sekosis backstage at WrestleMania. And they said it was about English beating me up.
Oh, God.
Matt is the nicest guy. If you've ever met Aiden English, he is the nicest guy in the world. God love him. He is the most passive human being I've ever met. He wouldn't fight a fire.
Was that day that you fought, that you got into the whatever it was, the headlock and the cocaine, was that your last day with WWE?
No, that was actually the day of the draft.
So how long were you there after that?
8 months.
So moving through those 8 months, why do you think that, what was the reason that only you got released and your partner didn't?
It's a couple things, really. Number one, I was very visible because of the stuff that had happened between the Enzo injury and the Coke can. I was very publicly visible for negative things. It didn't matter that ultimately you're talking about two unrelated things. A lot of people with the Enzo thing will point to Steve Austin saying it was my fault. As I pointed out earlier, Austin doesn't know fuck all about physics. First, the Irish whip is a work. Even if I threw him as hard as I could, he wouldn't have gone out of the ring like that. There's literally no way I could have made that happen if I tried. The spot that Enzo was going for is one he's done before. Bo Dallas did this very spot with no space. Literally, he did it with one step away from the ring or from the ropes and did not hurt himself. Bo is an amazing worker. Enzo is not. Enzo, with 3/4 of the ring, slid way too fast. Because he was running way too fast, which, again, I can't affect his speed at that position. And he clocked himself. I found out later he'd actually done that once before. When they did the match with him and Cass against the Revival in England, he actually KO'd himself as well. Not as bad, but same injury. So that happens. And then you have Austin basically burying me on his podcast. A lot of people reach to that as a source for how whatever their opinion is about me. And just in general, those two things are just very visible. I also had pitched an angle to Vince about a month before I got released, which means Vince now knew specifically who I was.
Uh-oh.
Not always a good thing.
Right.
Because now my face and name are in his head.
What was the angle?
I wanted to basically do an angle where English and I had an off-camera monkey. The whole joke is going to be you never see the monkey. It's just always the monkeys off camera, like raising havoc. But this is going to lead to a hair versus hair match with us against Breeze Dango and us getting our heads shaved. Because this has come up because Matt was already balding. And he just shaved his head actually at WrestleMania this year. But we were talking about it. He was like, fuck. He's like, I should just shave my head. I was like, fuck it. Let's do a hair versus hair match. I'll shave my head too. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, that's old school, man.
Yeah. So I pitched it. I was like, you look at us without hair. We're going to look like crazy people. That'll be awesome. So I pitched that angle. Vince seemed to like it, but it's the evil eye. You know, now he knows what I look like. Now he knows who I am. And now he knows he has these stories that have been brought to him.
Right.
That are attached to me.
And he's like, who the fuck is the monkey guy?
Yeah. And then the other half of that is English had never had any of this bad publicity put on him for anything. And he's always been generally a very, you know, amicable, pleasant guy. He's very upbeat, always a smile on his face. And then to top it off, he's married to Shaw Guerrero, and you know Shaw is Eddie's daughter, and Eddie is real tight with Malenko. So Malenko was always a very big advocate of English's, not necessarily of mine, but definitely of English's. So even if they were considering firing both of us, I could see Malenko definitely putting so on, look, man, he's a good kid. I know him. He works really hard. I think we can get more out of him if we keep him. And it can be that simple. If I don't have anybody who's willing to speak up for me doing the same, then I'm gone.
Did you have any advocates or good relationships with the agents backstage?
The only person I had a really good relationship with was Adam Pearce. But again, Adam was relatively new to the road at that point. So I don't think he was going to risk his position for me, which I don't blame him for. He's got a wife and kids, and I wasn't happy there. I wanted to quit, frankly. So my last match was at SmackDown following WrestleMania in Orlando. But at WrestleMania, after the show's over, I go back to the hotel. I'm in the elevator with Corey Graves. He gets on and goes, "Hey, man, what's up?" And I just look at him and I go, "I fucking hate this place. I want to quit." And he looks at me and goes, "Well, if you're unhappy, you shouldn't be here. You should just quit, man. There's no reason to be miserable." I just went, "I fucking can't." Because paying you so much money that it's too much money to quit, but not enough money to make you happy. It's one of those really awkward places to be.
So then Tuesday at the SmackDown taping was your last match. And then when did they tell you that you were released?
Wednesday.
That what, next morning they called you?
I think they called me around 11, but I was already had gone out to lunch to get Korean barbecue. And then I came back and I had a missed call from Carano.
And did you know before you even called back?
I figured. It was similar to when I got called up. I was like, there's only two reasons Carano calls you, you know?
What was the feeling like when he told you? Was it like a relief?
A little bit of pressure, a little bit of tension for a moment. That like deep inhale, and you hold your breath, and you go, and you let it out. And you're like, okay, I'm good. I'm good. I can keep going.
Were you told that creative has nothing for you, and were you told the door was open?
No. I was told very specifically, Vince feels my character has run its course.
Were you given any hope? Like, not that you wanted it, but a lot of times they'll say something like, go to Japan, work on your shit, and maybe we can revisit in a little bit. Any kind of hope for the future with WWE?
Nope.
So you feel they're just like, cut losses, fuck this guy. That's what you think?
I think they did not know what they had with me, and they believed all I had to offer was this gimmick, and once they tired of it, they were done.
Did you have a moment after that was done where you're like, my dream is over? Or were you more like, okay, let me show these motherfuckers what I can do?
Neither, really. I was more just relaxed because I was like, okay, I don't have to worry about that anymore. I get to go back to having fun. I had a 90-day no compete, as is standard for anyone leaving the main roster. And I had the first chance in 4 years at that point to actually think about wrestling and not be stressed. And I really sort of revamped a lot of the ways I thought about the business and a lot of the opinions I had on wrestling. So I was really happy to have not had to continue with WWE. If I'd kept working for WWE, if I'd worked in through the length of my contract that I was signed for, I would have been released at 37 or 38. At that point, I would have been in a position where I couldn't really do anything else. You know, the odds of me getting back into a company at that point anywhere in the world would be pretty low. So I looked at it as my release gives me the opportunity to actually go out there and really do something still, which I've been fortunate enough to get to work with some phenomenal people over the last year that I never would have gotten to work with if I'd stayed in WWE. Not counting house shows in NXT with like Jordan and Gable or Blake and Murphy or the two house shows we got to do with Cesaro and Neville. I didn't have very many, like I didn't really get to work with people that I wanted to work with. It wasn't necessarily that I was working with bad guys. It was just these weren't the people that I felt like were going to have the best matches that I could have with them. I felt like stylistically we weren't going to match.
And it's not anything that really caught on to your passion about the industry.
Exactly. Working for WWE kind of grinded down my passion for wrestling in a lot of ways. And I was able to get that back by having my 90 days to just think about wrestling in the least stressful way possible. And really, it changed my mind about a lot of stuff.
Do you still keep in contact with Aiden English?
Not regularly. I still follow his stuff and keep up on him. He still follows mine, keeps up on me. But at the end of the day, we have two separate lives. We still have to, you know, sort of, he's got his job, I've got mine.
Yeah. Are you happy with what he's doing now?
I'm glad he's getting featured more, honestly. Matt's a tremendously talented guy. And it's actually, if I have one complaint about him, it's that he is super athletic, but he doesn't want to show it because he's afraid of injuries.
So he's a bit from the Randy Orton school.
A bit, where he's like, his logic is, well, if I do this, whatever, this flip or this, because like he was a gymnast in high school, so he can do a lot of that stuff, like the backhand spring, tuck, front head spring, all that stuff. He doesn't want to use it in the ring because his fear is that, okay, I'll do it, and then I'm going to have to do it every night, and then I'm going to destroy my knees or I'm going to destroy my back. And it's like, yeah, dude, but you only have to, first of all, they can't make you do it. You can do it one or two times and get a huge pop for it. People will be like, oh, hey, this guy's got something more, you know? One of the lessons I've learned by being outside of the WWE system, because that's a conventional wisdom they tell you. It's like, oh, hey, if you do that, you got to do it every night. No, I don't. You can't make me. I can do whatever I want. I'm an adult. It's like when someone says, oh, you can't put pineapple on pizza. Yes, I can, because I'm an adult and I'm paying for that pizza. And I'm going to put whatever I want on it. If you want to put something else on your pizza, you can, because you're paying for it. But this is my money and it's going to go towards what I want to.
Were there moments in your developmental career and also WWE where they told you something like that and you said, no, I don't have to do that?
No, quite the contrary. If anything, I listened to everything I was told, which was a problem.
What would you have done differently?
I would not have listened to anyone. I would genuinely.
How long would you have lasted?
I don't know, but I would have been fired for who I am, not for who they thought I was.
Yeah. Well, if you could, in a short version, if you could sum up your WWE experience, how would you sum it up?
I think Chris Jericho owes me a award. He previously claimed he had it. I think I deserve it for the worst single year in WWE history. I think I beat him for a worst single year in WWE history because his worst single year was at least followed by a great year. Mine was not. I mean, well, mine was followed by a great year in wrestling, but not a great year in WWE.
Do you really think it was the worst year? I know you're kind of joking, but kind of serious. When you look back, you think it's up there with the worst years anybody ever had?
As far as a solid 12 months, I'd be interested to see who the competition is. Because like ones that pop to mind would be people like, say, the Dicks or...
Heartthrobs.
Heartthrobs. But a lot of those guys lasted like 3 to 6 months. A lot of them didn't make the full 12-month mark, which is kind of why I say the worst year. Even Enzo, I mean, is at a pretty rough ending, but that was still closer to 2 years or a year and a half than it was a year. So again, I'd be interested to see who else would be on that list of single year main roster runs to see who had a better or worse one than me.
Are you planning on buying Enzo's album when it drops?
Only if he does. You know how they have the interludes usually on hip hop albums?
Yeah, sure.
I would absolutely buy it. Purely if he did one where instead of referring to himself as a certified G and a bona fide stud, if he said that in accordance with Megan's law, he has to inform you that he is a registered sex offender.
Oh my God.
Well, let me tell you what this is called, why it ended. And a lot of times it's about truly why it ended. In this case, it's a lot of how it began, because now you're in really the prime of your career. You're really reinventing yourself and being, as you said, you were cut not for the person that you were, but who they thought you were. And now you get to be who you are. How much are you enjoying this MLW thing? Of course, we're with MLW Radio. You've got this great thing going with the MLW Wrestling. How much are you enjoying that right now?
A lot, actually. It's a lot of fun. It's been a nice change of pace because it's the first time I've been able to sort of do TV for wrestling where it hasn't been so restricted. Bruce Pritchard is one of the guys with MLW now. And I was given a promo and I was reading it and I didn't really like it. And I just asked Bruce, I was like, hey, verbiage-wise, do you want me to keep it like it is on the paper? He's all, no, you've been on TV before. I trust you. You say what you got to say. Awesome. There we go.
So if WWE called you right now and they said that, you know, they want to fix it and have another shot and you get to be yourself and be your new character you're doing, would you bite or no?
It depends on how much I trust that they're serious about that. If I'm going back, I'm going to wind up in the same position that I was in before, miserable. I don't want to do that. Maybe I'm the crazy one here, but the highest order for me with wrestling is being able to enjoy myself and be happy. I'm paying my bills and making a living as a wrestler outside of WWE. I don't need to be there to make a living. I don't need to be there to make money. Being there might be financially beneficial, admittedly, but if it's at the price of, shall we say, my soul, my enjoyment, my ability to like smile, why would I want that?
There are other ways to get paid besides money.
Exactly.
Quality of life.
For those who don't know or haven't seen the new MLW TV show, can you describe a little bit of what it is that Simon Grimm is doing on there?
Oh, so, well, actually, I'm Simon Gotch on there because, as I said, I bought the rights to the name. That was the reason, because they liked the name and wanted me to keep it. So I was like, okay, I'll buy the rights. What I've been doing lately is I've been teaming with Tom Lawler as part of Team Filthy. Tom Lawler, you might know from the UFC. And I've actually been doing a challenge match, the Simon Gotch prize fight challenge, where I put up $250 to anyone who can defeat me.
Carney style, right?
Oh, yeah. But the pause being to make it seem like it's going to be a ton of money, but it's actually not. It's a very reasonable sum. It's like you could buy 250 double cheeseburgers at McDonald's off the dollar.
Hey, that's what you got for doing the Triple H skull mask thing at Mania, right?
Exactly. So if anything, that's a really good deal. This is as much money as you get paid to help Triple H with his entrance at WrestleMania. So the basic idea is that I'm putting an open challenge out there. My first challenge came in the form of a young man who is a student of famed capoeira mestre Jairo. I immediately suplexed him and pile drove him. So it did go well for him. You know, the offer's on the table for anyone in the world who wants a shot at $250. I'm not sure it's of my money. I know it's of I have the money. I don't know if it came out of my paycheck. I should probably ask them about that because that would change the paradigm a little bit.
Well, you know, you might want to get that back to court at some moment.
I should, actually. He's probably, I'm probably going to find out years from now that that was supposed to be like Sammy Callahan's money, and he's going to be, and that's why Sammy isn't talking to me right now. Is he still mad about the $250?
Do you have heat with Sammy Callahan?
No, I love Sammy.
Oh, okay.
I'm just name dropping him because he's a nice guy.
Hey, bro. So if fans want to follow you on Twitter, Instagram, reach out to you for bookings, promoters, any stuff like that, is there any handles you want to give?
Well, you can find me at Twitter or on Twitter at Devious Journey. There's a joke in there if you have a dictionary. I'm also still at GotStyleWWE on Instagram because Instagram won't let me change my handle because I'm certified.
Isn't that annoying? I can't do that on Twitter either.
Well, I did it on Twitter, but I just lost my blue check. I sort of had to come to terms with that. If you do it on it, they won't let me on Instagram, period. Like, I can't even losing the blue check, it won't let me. If you're looking up, I'm bookings at Simon or booking Simon at yahoo.com. Is where I usually take my booking emails. I believe that's where we converse for this one. This weekend, actually, I'm going to be up in Buffalo for Empire State Wrestling. Me, Jimmy Jacobs, a bunch of other people are going to be on the card. I'm always about. Obviously, MLW on BN Sports. There's another place you can see me. Prestige Wrestling over in Oregon. I'm there a lot. Maverick Pro down in Los Angeles. Going to be there for a while. So, yeah, again, keep your eyes open, and I'll be there.
Hey, man. Well, we appreciate you being on. This is awesome.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks a lot. And it goes to show that this is someone, I don't think I even knew your voice. I'd watch you wrestle so much. So
yeah,
make sure, guys, that you check out everything that he's doing.
Which is funny because I can't tell you again how many people have talked about how I don't know how to cut a promo. And then my first reaction is like, well, you never heard me talk. So generally speaking, how would you know if I could or couldn't? Even if, let's just devil's advocate. I could be the greatest speaker in the world. You don't know. You've never heard me speak in a promo. You've only ever heard it in interviews after the fact. This is insane.
You know what I think you should do is do like a catchphrase at the beginning and a catchphrase at the end and then put a bunch of disjointed facts and lines in the middle of it. What do you think?
I could also go the other route of catchphrase, imply I don't know who my opponent is, imply he's a homosexual as though that were a bad thing. Use another catchphrase and then be done. Do you know whose promo I just described?
I think I do.
It's kind of weird when you break it down like that. You realize, wow, that is what he did a lot. If you guys can, though, I'm not going to say it, but if you guys can guess, it's not a knock on him. It's just a weird thing I noticed was that was all of his promos. And I think even John Cena called him out on it at one point. It's not cool to say that stuff, man. It's like it's not okay.
Well, we'll leave that to the fans' imagination. But one thing we won't leave to the fans' imagination and the listeners is that you're a great guest, dude. Thank you so much for being here. We're all watching you. Everybody keep up on all of social media what he's doing. Thank you once again for joining us, Simon, on Why It Ended. Wow. Simon Gotch ain't afraid of shit, Robbie. What did you think about all the stuff he had to say?
Well, I definitely am pretty sure, you know, I'm going out on a limb here, but I think he doesn't like Enzo. I mean, would you agree?
I think when you call someone a cunt, unless you're British, you hate them.
I don't think I've ever called anyone that word, and that's actually telling the truth. But he kind of, you know, called out Steve Austin for being wrong, too. So I'd say, you know, he's a little ballsy.
No, he definitely is, and it was a great interview, and thank you so much to Simon Gotch for doing it. And also, we got a lot of stuff going on. We are going to be at StarCast in September with a special panel. Some of your favorite Why It Ended people will be there with us, as well as maybe one or two yet to come. And we have a very, very special announcement for what is sure to be the greatest episode of Why It Ended ever next week. You want to break the news, Robbie?
Yeah, it involves a man who was involved, in a lot of crazy things throughout his career, but he was, would you agree that he was in one of the most remembered wrestling segments possibly of all time where he got thrown through a glass barbershop window? Do you know who I'm talking about here?
I think, let me think here. Well, we definitely have Marty Jannetty, and let me tell you, we're Why It Ended. We're going to ask all the questions. We're going to ask about Chuck Austin. If you don't know who that is, Google it. We're going to ask about his daughter, and we're going to take him through his entire career and the 8 different times he left WWE. We have a lot of time to prep for this. What are you looking forward to talking to Marty Jannetty next week on Why It Ended?
all of the above. I'm not looking forward to one thing more than the other because everything is going to be insane.
And everything's always insane here on Why It Ended. You can reach us at all our social media platforms on at Why It Ended. Of course, check us out on YouTube. We are going to start posting some exclusive clips from the Marty Jannetty interview on YouTube very soon, maybe even tomorrow. So go to whereitended.com for that. Robbie, if we want to get a hold of you and find out where you're wrestling next, the Robert Strauss brand is going to be at House of Hardcore.
I start with House of Hardcore June 1st and 2nd. But if you want to catch me this weekend, Saturday I will actually be in Surveyor, West Virginia for SCW. And then Sunday I will be in Salem, Ohio for a show and a seminar for QCW.
If people want to get a hold of you for bookings or want to get a hold of you for anything else, how do people get a hold of Robbie E., a.k.a. Robert Strauss Brand?
RobbieEbookings@gmail.com, and then of course on Twitter at Robbie E Impact, Facebook Robert Strauss, and Instagram Real Robbie E.
And of course you can get a hold of me at Matt Coon Music, and we are Why It Ended. Marty Jannetty next week, guys.
I can't wait.
All right. That's fucking, it's gonna be fucking crazy. All right, cool, man.
The world of MLW Radio never stops.